taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you are everyday Americans.
Hello there, everyday Americans, and welcome. You have joined the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. We help restore liberty and justice to our republic. And today I'm asking a very simple question. Can Americans trust their elections anymore? Let's start with a look at a court case involving the election integrity laws, specifically this time coming out of Arizona.
There have been a lot of claims lately that all voter integrity laws from Republicans are racist, while all from Democrats are more toward free and fair elections. Now, beyond the partisan propaganda, a recent case at the Supreme Court asked the question if Arizona's election laws are racist. Let's start with the Voting Rights Act. The Democratic National Committee, the DNC, claimed that Arizona's voting law violated Section 2 of this act. No voting qualification or prerequisite to voting or standard practice or procedure shall be imposed or implied by any state or political subdivision in a manner which results in a denial or abridgment of the right of any citizen of the United States to vote on account of race or color. Section 2, subsection A of the Voting Rights Act is Congress making law that is necessary and proper to execute the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, which reads, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude." Now, the Voting Rights Act went on to detail what might deny someone the right to vote. A violation of subsection A is established if, based on the totality of circumstances, it is shown that political processes leading to nomination or election in a state or political subdivision are not equally open to participation by members of a class of citizens protected by subsection A, in that its members have less opportunity than other members of the electorate to participate in the political process and to elect representatives of their choice. The extent to which members of a protected class have been elected to office in the state or political subdivision is one circumstance which may be considered, provided that nothing in this section establishes a right to have members of a protected class elected in numbers equal to their proportion in the population. There are a few things to notice with this part of the legislation. First, it's not enough to show that a single circumstance of discrimination based on race or color is a violation of the law. It's the totality of circumstances. Second, since this act covers both elections and nominations to office, it would apply to primaries and caucuses as well. Also, this law does not establish a quota. There is no right to have a certain number of those elected to office based on the proportion of the population. Now, let's get to the meat of the law as it relates to this case. It is shown that the political processes leading to nomination or election in the state or political subdivision are not equally open to participation by members of a class or citizen protected by subsection A. Now, there are several ways the election process could not be equally open to a group based on race or color. While the most obvious, a law restricting such access would be a violation, the law takes into consideration other ways of unlawful discrimination, in that its members have less opportunity than other members of the electorate to participate in the political process and to elect representatives of their choice. This is what the DNC alleged in their lawsuit, that two parts of Arizona's election law provide less opportunity for blacks, American Indians, and Hispanics to vote. The first was a law requiring that ballots cast in the wrong precinct not be counted. The second, that only certain people are allowed to collect early ballots, was claimed to be enacted with discriminatory intent. Let's take a look at these complaints separately. First, Arizonans who vote in person on election day in a county that uses the precinct system must vote in the precinct to which they are assigned based on their address. If a voter votes in the wrong precinct, the vote is not counted. Some counties divide themselves up into voting precincts. According to Arizona law, citizens must vote in the precinct where they live. According to Justice Kagan and Justices Breyer and Sotomayor, who joined in her dissent, the out-of-precinct policy results in Hispanic and African-American voters' ballots being thrown out at a statistically higher rate than those of whites. Does the fact that Hispanic and black voters cast their ballots in the wrong precinct at a higher rate than whites, a fact I did not find the dissent providing any evidence of, mean that they have less opportunity to vote. Justice Kagan also claims that Arizona has more offenders of their out-of-precinct law than any other state. Again, I ask the question, how would the fact that out-of-precinct voting happens more often in Arizona than other states show that the law provides less opportunity to vote based on race or color? So according to the majority of the court, it doesn't. Having to identify one's polling place and then travel there to vote does not exceed the usual burdens of voting. In addition, the state made extensive efforts to reduce the impact of out-of-precinct policy on a number of valid votes ultimately cast. Example, by sending a sample ballot to each household that includes a voter's proper polling location. The burden of identifying and traveling to one's assigned precinct are also modest when considering Arizona's political process as a whole. The state offers other easy ways to vote, which likely explains why out-of-precinct votes on Election Day make up such a small and apparently diminishing portion of overall ballots cast. See, next, let's look at the second claim by the DNC, that limiting third-party ballot collection is racist. Arizona's law banning most third-party ballot collection also results in a significant race-based disparity in voting opportunities. The problem with that law, again, lies in facts nearly unique to Arizona. Here, the presence of rural Native American communities that lack ready access to mail service. Now, at first, this argument by the dissent seems to have merit. However, as I reviewed their argument, one thing stood out. Justice Kagan only discussed the option of mailing in an early ballot. The majority of the court noted that postal service is one of several methods of sending in early ballots. Arizonans can submit early ballots by going to a mailbox, a post office, an early ballot drop box, or an authorized election official's office. Now, the majority also compared the effort required to find a mailbox, post office, ballot drop box, authorized election official office, or a family member, household member, or caregiver to do so for you with the compelling interest of preserving the integrity of its election procedures. See, dissent mentioned that it's a crime in Arizona for someone to tamper with a ballot, but as we've seen, laws don't stop people from committing crimes. While the dissent agrees with the district court that tamper-evident envelopes and a rigorous voter signature verification procedure protect against any such attempts. Recent elections show that's not entirely true, with significant problems with signature verification reported in Nevada, Texas, Michigan, and Georgia. Furthermore, while such procedures may limit the tampering with ballots, they do nothing to prevent the introduction of fake ballots into a system by third parties with a political agenda. Again, setting aside the partisan question, do the Arizona laws provide unequal opportunities for people of all races and colors to vote? Not inherently. Though a case could be made that there need to be sufficient legitimate ballot drop-off locations where postal locations are not readily available. I decided not to go through all the legal mumbo-jumbo with you this time, and there was plenty, but to focus on the question of racism, since it's used as a bludgeon so often in society today. As the court found, it is not racist to put in basic laws to ensure voter integrity. It's not racist to require that people vote in the county or precinct in which they live. And it's not racist to limit who has access to ballots before they are counted. Now, sometimes I wonder, who is the racist? The person claiming everyone's vote should be protected, or the one who claims the rules to limit opportunities for fraud are racist?
So that was the case before the Supreme Court. And again, it brought up some very interesting issues. I think the only argument that might have had merit would have to do with the availability of early ballot drop-off locations in extremely rural areas. I don't know all the details. That would be the only area I see that there might be an issue, but that obviously that didn't appear to be the focus of the complaint. And even Justice Kagan pointed out that, or when she was making her dissent, that she only focused on the Postal Service. There are plenty of other ways to drop off a ballot early in Arizona. But what's interesting is, why is it so important? You know, there's been a lot of talk lately about Americans' trust of institutions. Now, part of me is a little unsettled with that. Not the lack of trust, the fact that we put our trust in institutions rather than in people. But that's kind of a sidebar. The question is, can we trust our elections? Because if we can't trust our elections, well, then are we still a republic? And that, to me, is the true concern. Now, I've talked about it before. There is evidence, and there has been evidence, that there were problems with the November 2020 election. The presidential election was corrupted by at least five states that unconstitutionally chose electors to vote for president. By the way, if you're new to this program and you're not familiar, the people don't vote for president. The people vote for electors that their state send to vote for president. It's why we have, it's the Electoral College, but we're not taught that in school. So most people don't realize that the people don't vote for president, the states do. And the states get a number of electors based on their representation in Congress. Those electors are chosen in a manner determined by the legislature of the state. Most legislatures, in fact, all legislatures have decided that the primary way of doing that is via a popular election in the state. But the Constitution says the manner of choosing electors must be a decision by the state legislature. So when the courts come in and change the manner of appointing electors, in other words, they come in and say, no, we're going to extend voting beyond the date set by the legislature, or we're going to allow a type of voting that wasn't allowed by the legislature. That may be perfectly legal for state offices. It may even be legal for congressional offices. It is not legal for the electors for president of the United States. So that was problem number one. But there also has been, you know, eyewitness testimony. There's been videos about the problems with the way that ballots are handled. For an election to be trustworthy, I say it must be free, fair, and open. Free means anybody who is legally eligible to vote must be allowed to vote. You know, obviously, if you are not a citizen of the United States, you're not eligible to vote. If you are a convicted felon and have had your right to vote taken away from you as part of that punishment, you're not allowed to vote. If you have already voted either in that precinct or in another precinct, you're not legally allowed to vote. And it's important that our elections be free. Every illegitimate ballot cast steals the vote of a legitimate citizen of the United States. It's not simply, you know, euphemisms of, you know, ballot fraud, ballot tampering. It is theft. It is stealing your right to vote. So with that, you know, we look at other things and we start getting into some more other areas like the statistical anomalies that, you know, and expert testimony, that there are people that are showing that these numbers just don't add up, especially when you start seeing precincts and counties where more ballots were cast than people actually live in the county. These are all problems. And the problem I want to talk about today is as these problems mount, as we see problems, people don't immediately question the legitimacy of elections, right? There's always going to be some number of problems. You're always going to have people that try to game the system. You're always going to have people that try to cheat. You're always going to have people that simply make mistakes. Those are all possibilities. It is how we handle those problems that can either reinforce or destroy our faith in the election process. And if you do not trust that the election is free, that it is fair, meaning that only valid ballots are counted, right? And that it is open. In other words, it can be audited, it can be tracked, and that is done in the open. Ballots are counted in the open. Ballots are handled in the open where everyone can see it and everyone can do that. When those processes break down, and rather than dealing with those problems, we start covering up those problems. We start finding reasons not to deal with those problems. Then the question is, how do you trust the election anymore? How is that any different than elections in Cuba or in Iran or in North Korea? I don't even know if North Korea has elections, but I mean, I remember the days of the Soviet Union when the election was known, the outcome of the election was known before a single ballot was cast. We kind of have that again in Iran, in Venezuela, in Cuba. If you can't trust the elections, are we the land of the free? It's an important question. It is one of the fundamental functions of a republic is that the people are electing their representatives and that they're doing it freely and fairly. So when I see people trying to find ways of dealing with these problems, when you recognize there's a problem and people are trying to deal with them, that to me, it bolsters my confidence in the election. When I see people doing everything they can to stop that, well, then that makes me question the legitimacy of those elections. So let's take a look at what's been going on in Texas. Now, Texas is one of several states. They've been passing legislation trying to make it, while still making it easy to vote, making it more difficult to cheat. That's what we should all want, right? We should want easy to vote, hard to cheat. Well, in doing this, the legislature of Texas is controlled by the Republican Party. They were moving these processes through. So a group of Democrats basically, they ran away and hid. Well, they didn't really hide because they were on social media, on TV. They ran away. They wanted to deny the representatives of the people of Texas the ability to establish their own election law. Oh, I know they were claiming they were trying to protect election laws and they were trying to avoid racist laws that they can't yet prove as anything racist. They simply make these outrageous claims without any proof. But let's face it. These Democratic representatives represent a group of people in the state of Texas. That is their job. They don't represent all of them. They represent a subset of them. There are other representatives that represent the rest of the citizens of the state of Texas. And what these Democrats that claim they are for democracy, even though we're a republic, not a democracy, these Democrats who claim to be for democracy are denying the people of Texas a democratic process that they claim to support. In other words, when the representatives of the majority of the people in Texas say, we need to fix some things, these Democrats deny them that ability. The rest is show. All the other stuff people have been talking about is all show. The private planes, the quote unquote spreading of COVID, the testimony before the Congress, that is all political theater. What these Democratic representatives in Texas have done is deny to the people their ability to pass legislation they think is necessary, that they think is wholesome and necessary for the public good, which, by the way, is the very first grievance in the Declaration of Independence, that the king has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. I would think that trying to keep election fraud out of the process would be wholesome and necessary to the public good. And if these representatives have an argument that it truly is racist, they can show, not simply make the claim that it's racist, to provide evidence, to provide facts to this case. I'd listen to them. But if their answer is, if we can't win, we're going to take our ball and go home, then not only are they denying to the people of Texas their right to legislate for themselves, to say in their legislation, they're denying their own moniker of Democrats. They're not interested in democracy. They're interested in the Democratic Party. They're interested in their party winning, which brings up a very interesting question. Since it seems to me most of the people complaining about basic rules that would ensure the integrity of an election come from the Democratic Party, who is more interested in protecting your right to have a say in who represents you. See, that you know me, a pox on both their houses. I don't like the Republicans. I don't like the Democrats. But when I see a specific party doing everything they can to prevent tightening voter laws to make sure that all the ballots that are cast and counted are done freely, fairly, and openly, I have to ask why. I have theories. I'm sure as my listeners, you have theories as well, but it certainly brings up the question, why? Because this idea that it's to prevent racism in the election just does not hold water. The only way that I can think of that a voter ID law is racist is if you truly believe blacks and Hispanics and others of color just are incapable of getting an ID. And I'm sorry, I have met way too many blacks and Hispanics and Asians and Native Americans, and you name the list, that have a photo ID to believe that. So I don't think it's a problem to get a voter ID. I don't think it's a problem to minimize the number of people who handle a ballot between the time it is cast and the time it is counted. I don't believe that that's a problem. I don't believe that it is racist to say third parties should not be, in general, handling ballots, people that are not in the open, people that are not held legally accountable. To me, that's not a question of race. That's a question of integrity. But I guess to a racist, everything is about race. And yeah, I just called the majority of the leadership of the Democratic Party racist. But that's how they're acting. Now, what I also found interesting is some of the actions that have been proposed about this walkout. From the attorney general claiming they would be arrested when they set foot back in Texas, to governor vetoing a bill for funding the legislature until these people come back. Again, this is political showdown, and that's what this is all about. And really, I'm less worried about that than I am the basic question, can we trust elections in Texas? Everything else is theater. Everything else that people are whining about, that they're complaining about, is political theater. And sadly, way too many Americans get wrapped up in the political theater and they miss the actual problem that is behind all of this. They worry about, oh, look at their showing off in Congress, or people have been getting COVID that they've met, or even the fact of how much does it cost, and what's the attorney general doing, what's the governor going to do. That's all theater. That is all distraction. That's the magician waving his hand at you to get you to look over here rather than seeing what's really going on. And that is a subversion of the Republican process of government. The Republican form of government in Texas. Not the Republican Party controlled, the Republican form of government. This is a soft coup. This is the Democrats saying, we're going to take over. And if you do something we don't like, even though we don't have the majority, we will simply deny you the ability to do what the people of Texas have asked you to do. And they still have the gall to call themselves Democrats. Now, before we head out to the break, I want to remind you, I'm heading through North Dakota. I'll be hitting Wyoming shortly, and I am doing my Knowing Your Rights tour. I'm teaching people a little bit about the Constitution, about how it protects their rights, what they can do to recognize when their rights are violated, how they can defend them, how they can assert them. And I'm doing this, like I said, right now I'm going through North Dakota and Wyoming. I'm looking to set up events in other locations. If you want to find out more, please go to constitutionstudy.com/tour. You'll find out more about the tour. You'll find out all the locations I'm speaking, and you can do more. If I'm not coming to a location near you, please head down to the bottom of the page. You can request I bring the Knowing Your Rights tour to you. It does not have to be a big fancy event. You don't need a convention hall. You don't need a conference. All you need is a place where people who are truly interested in the Constitution and their rights can get together and have an honest discussion with a Q&A. I always end these up with a Q&A. So if you have questions, I'll be more than happy to answer them while we're there. Now, one thing about doing a trip like this is it's a lot of work. I've been running around crazy getting ready for it, but it also tends to wear you down. I'm hitting 6 cities in 6 days. All right, so I've got a couple day drive up, I got a couple day drive back, and I've got 6 cities in 6 days. And that just wears you down, which is why I'm bringing with me Healthy Cells Immune Super Boost. You meet a lot of people, you shake a lot of hands, you breathe around a lot of people. It is easy to get sick. And again, not just COVID, with anything. So head over to healthycell.com/outloud. As an America Out Loud listener, you get 20% off your very first order. Maybe you want to try the Immune Super Boost. Maybe you want to try the REM Sleep or the Focus and Recall. Maybe you want to set up a subscription so this stuff just keeps coming to you. You can all find that. You can find it all out on healthycell.com/outloud. And again, you'll get 20% off your first order. And I'll be right back after this short break.
Well, my fellow Americans, how did you feel watching footage on the news of domestic terrorists looting our stores and burning our cities down? You were probably disgusted and angry as much as I was. It's disturbing what's going on. Well, you'd be shocked to know that your shopping habits are supporting these extremists. Companies like Amazon, Nike, Disney, FedEx, it's an endless list, and they've been supporting these radical groups. Let's stop supporting companies that fund these extremist groups. We can all do our part. Visit shoptotheright.com and you'll find businesses in a nationwide database and companies that are aligned with our American values. Visit shoptotheright.com and let's all make a difference.
Because of COVID-19, the average American worries about their immune health 4 times a day. That's 112 times per year. To minimize the worries, leading nutritional supplement company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost, an immune supplement that contains 15 full doses of science-backed nutrients like vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in a one-a-day pill-free gel pack. It tastes great, is convenient on the go, and it's more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Supporting a strong and resilient immune system can be simple. Go to healthycell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Immune Super Boost. That's healthycell.com, HEALTHYCELL, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Today, America stands at the crossroads of history. Our actions will determine the fate of our nation. Well, that journey starts here and starts now. We invite you to join us in making the ultimate difference. Subscribe to our podcast and newsletters. Turn notifications on and stay in the know. You'll find all that back at AmericaOutloud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. Thank you for rejoining the Constitution Study. Today, we're talking about, can we even trust our elections anymore? Now, I made the point in the first half of the show that, to me, it's less of an issue that there are problems with elections than how we deal with those problems. As I said, there's a lot of reasons we could have problems. Sure, there's fraud, there's malfeasance, there's people actively trying to manipulate the election, and we certainly don't want that to happen. But there's also other times when it's a simple mistake. Somebody, you know, votes in the wrong precinct because they forgot to check, or there's a lot of reasons why, while it's not intentionally doing something wrong, it's misfeasance. They made a mistake. My issue is not that this happens. This is always going to happen. We're human beings. We make mistakes. The question is, how do we deal with it? I've always looked at somebody and said, I'm less concerned with when you make a mistake than with how you deal with the mistake. So when I look at what's going on in Arizona, now we talked about the Arizona law and how it was handled at the Supreme Court. But I'm looking here what's been going on in Arizona, and I have some serious questions. Let's start with this. A group called the American Oversight filed a lawsuit as a public records request to get information about communication between the Senate of Arizona and external vendors on how they were doing the audit. So again, Arizona is going through a very extensive audit of the 2020 election. They are working with third-party individuals, with private contractors. There is communication between the Senate officials and those vendors. And this group called American Oversight wanted to see that communication. Now, that communication, it's a public entity. The Senate of Arizona is a public entity. Unless they're claiming some sort of state security, there's no reason I see that that information should not be open. This is that sunlight's the best disinfectant. If they're doing everything right, that information should be open. If they're doing everything right, they shouldn't have a problem with it. However, the Senate filed a motion to dismiss the lawsuit relating to the audit and what's being done in Maricopa County. Now, this has a smell problem to me. Again, this is the Senate of Arizona. They are the servants of the people of Arizona. Why do they not want their communication in such a critical aspect of our republic to be made public? Now, I don't know if they're hiding anything. I don't know why they pass this. I'm not going to claim to read their minds. But I'll tell you what, it doesn't pass the sniff test. You have to wonder, why does the Senate of Arizona not want this audit, the communications regarding this audit, open to the sunshine? Why do they not want to be transparent about it? I do not know. What I do know is that somewhere in mid-July, a judge basically said, we're not going to dismiss this. To me, as the judge says, it's difficult to conceive of a case with more compelling public interest demanding public disclosure and security. So that was from Judge Michael Kemp of the Arizona Superior Court in Maricopa County. So I am glad that this motion was suppressed, but it still leaves the shadow of question. Can we trust what the Senate of Arizona is doing if they don't want what they're communicating to be open? And the sad part is, even if it's just a few questionable actors, even if it's just a few people that maybe have stuff they don't want open, the entire Senate of Arizona is being painted with a brush of, can we trust you? Because you're trying to keep secret this communication. Which brings me to the next article I found. This came actually I saw it on the Epoch Times. This was July 22nd. It's been around a while. Apparently, if you've been reading the news, Maricopa County was served subpoenas to provide audit information to the Arizona Senate. Now, records relating to the election audit, right? Apparently, Maricopa County, according to the Senate, is refusing to fully comply with the subpoenas related to the audit, and they're not happy. So, issue number one, why is Maricopa County doing this? Now, I can see a couple of reasons. One is, well, Maricopa County has something to hide. That's a possibility. I don't know for sure. But then the other reason could be that the Senate is using it as a political football. In other words, they're less worried about what actually was in there, but they're looking to get dirt so they can spin whatever comes out of the audit when they finally report on that? I don't know. What I do know is that the Senate of Arizona has issued a subpoena. And look, I actually have an issue with the general idea of legislatures issuing subpoenas. I believe they should go through the exact same process that everyone else does, and that is if you want to get records from someone else that is not within your direct control, you need to get a warrant. You need to go to court. You need to show probable cause. You need to get a warrant. I don't see anywhere, again, I don't know the Constitution of Arizona that well, but when from a U.S. standpoint, I don't see anywhere where Congress is given the authority to issue subpoenas. Although I suppose it could be construed under the necessary and proper clause, but I don't want to get too far off the field. Here's what we have. We have the Senate of Arizona issuing a subpoena. Don't know the details. Don't know why. We have Maricopa County officials refusing to comply completely. Not sure why. I haven't seen the reasons why. Here's what I do know. Basically, the Senate of Arizona wants to hold these Maricopa County officials in contempt for refusing to comply with their subpoena. And there's one senator that's stopping it. Now, this senator happens to be a Republican. So for everyone here who thought like in Texas, the Democrats are holding up the works, nope. This is a Republican holding up the works. I think it's I'm curious because what this tells me is, okay, now can I trust the audit out of Maricopa County? Are they hiding things? Are they withholding information from the transparency of the public for a reason? Or is the Arizona Senate looking for dirt and Maricopa County said, listen, there's information, there's private information. Maybe the information that the Senate's looking for includes private details of voters, which the Senate may not be entitled to. So there's a lot going on. But again, from a Tennessean looking at an Arizona situation, can I trust their election? Can I trust the outcome of the report on their audit? And based on these machinations, can I trust their next election? 2020 is behind us. There's nothing we can do to go change what happened in 2020. The question is, can I trust them in 2022 and 2024? These are the things that concern me about these problems. And then one last one. This is another one, again, dealing with the Senate of Arizona. The Senate president, a Karen Fan, made a very interesting statement that the state's presidential electors cannot be recalled. Now, I want to back a couple things up here. So the first thing we need to understand is that I'm curious, does that mean that the extent of the audit in the state of Arizona is the presidential election? What about all the other elections? See, Americans, we tend to focus on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. We put all of our hopes and dreams on a single person in the White House. So we tend to focus on that. But that is not the seat of all power. The president is not the most powerful man in the country, at least not legally. So my first question is, okay, is this because there's a lot of questions about what happens? You know, if the audit shows that there were problems in the Arizona election, if after the audit of Maricopa County, it's found that President Trump had more voters than now President Biden, what do we do? And this is a question I hear asked a lot. And the Senate president basically said, what do we do? The election for president has happened. I don't mean November 3rd, 2020. I mean the actual election for president. A group of electors in Arizona met, they voted, they certified the election. They then sent those records to the president of the Senate of the United States. They were counted, they were tallied, they were certified, and we have President Joe Biden. There is no mechanism to go back and say, oops, our bad. Now we got to go back and redo that whole actual presidential election electoral college thingy again. There's no mechanism for that. So we're stuck with it. Now, does that, to me, that means it's all the more important we make sure that the next election has fewer problems than the last election. Again, it's not going to be perfect. There are going to be problems. We need to put tools in place to minimize those problems so that the next election has fewer problems than the last election. And for everybody who's hoping that, you know, suddenly, magically, one of these states, one of these audits is going to show up and everybody's going to say, oh, we're wrong. It was Trump all along and Biden gets kicked out and Trump gets brought in. Sorry, that's not going to happen. I know a lot of people are disappointed because, again, they're putting their hope in a person, in President Trump. But that isn't a republic. That is despotism. At least according to this guy by the name of George Washington. You see, in his farewell address, he talked about the revenge natural to party dissension and all the problems it caused. And in that, he said, the disorders and miseries which result gradually incline the minds of men to seek security and repose in the absolute power of an individual. And sooner or later, the chief of some prevailing faction, more able or more fortunate than his competitors, turns his disposition to the purposes of his own elevation on the ruins of public liberty. So for everyone who is out there saying, oh, all we have to do is get President Trump back and life will be perfect, no, that's despotic. The answer is not in a person, and it's not in a party. It's in the rule of law, and it's in the policies, the ideas that created our Constitution. And if we walk away from those, then a person will not save us. At best, a person will keep us from sliding deeper until the next person comes along. Now, there are plenty of people out there that are saying, well, you know, sure, there were some problems, but it wasn't enough to overturn the results. Well, I have a couple problems with that. Problem number one is, how much fraud will you accept? In other words, at what point does fraud become worth dealing with? How many Americans will you allow to have their votes and their rights stolen before you deem it worthy of actually doing something about it? So whether you're a politician or a pundit or just some talking head, anybody who claims that we don't have to worry about voter fraud because it wasn't enough to overturn the election basically is saying we don't mind corruption as long as there isn't too much of it, as long as it doesn't offend our sensibilities. It reminds me of a joke I heard of a father. His children came to him wanting to go see some really disgusting movie. I mean, it was one of those, you know, it was a bad movie. And he kept saying, no, you know, there's terrible language in it, and there's no, you're not going. And the kid said, well, Dad, it's a great movie. There's lots of action. There's great special effects. Yeah, there's some bad stuff in it, but it's just a little bit. It's not enough to ruin the whole movie. It's just a little bit. So the dad tried to figure out a way to communicate his concerns to his children. So he said, all right, let me go away. Let me think about it for a while. He calls him down and says, listen, I know you're disappointed about the movie, but here, I made you some brownies. I used the best ingredients. I found the best chocolate, the freshest eggs, everything. This is the best brownies that can be made by man. Well, except for one thing. You see, I was running a little low on batter, so I went out in the backyard and I cleaned up some of the dog exhaust, some of the leavings from the dog. I had to mix some of that in so that I'd have enough so that everybody could have a brownie. But it's just a little bit. You'd never notice it. Go ahead. Have the brownies. For some reason, the kids didn't want to eat the brownies. Well, isn't that exactly what people are saying? It's like, hey, we know there's bad stuff in these elections, but that's okay. Don't worry about it. Eat the brownies. They have some bad stuff in it, but, you know, how much theft, right? We talk about fraud. Fraud in an election is theft. You are stealing the right to vote of legitimate votes, legitimate voters, when you vote illegitimately. How many Americans are you willing to deny their right to vote because you can't be bothered with it? So that's problem number one. Problem number two, well, that's a little interesting. This is a little different. See, the problem is, if there are problems in elections in one state, at what point do other states start looking at what they're doing going, you know, maybe we have problems too. See, back in July, Wisconsin lawmakers started calling for a full forensic audit of their election. Why? They saw what's been going on in Arizona and Georgia. They saw what those two audits have found and said, maybe we need to take a closer look. State Representative Timothy Ramthan formally requested a more comprehensive audit when he saw that what's been going on in other states. And he asked himself, I'm assuming he asked himself, well, if they're happening in Arizona, if it's happening in Georgia, could it be happening here? See how this distrust in the election begins to snowball. If I can't trust what happened in Georgia and I can't trust what happened in Arizona, can I trust what happened in my state? These snowball. They tend to pick up people along the way. Now, was there evidence of more serious problems in Wisconsin? Not that I'm aware of. But what you see are people now questioning their own elections because of the problems they're seeing in other elections. And we really need to be cognizant of that. Again, elections need to be open. It's not they should be open. It's not if nice that they're open. They must be open or they are not trustworthy. You know, shortly after I moved here to Tennessee, I learned about a very interesting story. It's called the Battle of Athens, Tennessee. You can find it on my website, constitutionstudy.com. And the short version is they had a corrupt sheriff and a corrupt county officials, and they were stealing elections. And I mean, blatantly, I mean, not even, you know, hiding it. You had sheriff's deputies, determining who could and couldn't vote in direct contradiction to the law. You had legal voters turned away. You had illegal voters allowed to vote. And when the process was starting, men were coming back from the war in Europe. And these GIs were very concerned with what they saw. So they put up their own candidates. And then they saw what was happening with the election being stolen. They saw that the ballot boxes were collected and then whisked away to the sheriff's office and counted in secret. Nobody watching, nobody observing. They actually went to the National Guard armory, withdrew weapons, and there was actually a gunfight in Athens, Tennessee, to stop election fraud, to prevent the counting, the illegal counting of ballots, the improper counting of ballots. And when they finally got a hold of the ballot boxes and tally sheets, they found, guess what? Illegal ballot counting. They found ballot box stuffing. They weren't actually necessarily putting ballots in the box. They were just counting up extras on the tally. I don't want to get to that point. I don't want to get to the point where men and women, especially those who have fought for our freedoms, feel the need to get arms to protect our right to vote. So when I see a state that has had a problem with their election, a state like, Pennsylvania, and I see one of their legislative houses, when I see the Senate passes a very strong voter integrity bill, I like that. That's a good thing. You know, they're going to require a voter ID. I need an ID to get on an airplane. I need an ID to I need an ID to buy alcohol or certain medications. It's not that hard to get an ID, and it's not that big a deal to ask for an ID to vote. They also talk about signature verification, updating the voter rolls, making sure that the people who are registered to vote actually are still alive and still live in the precinct where they're voting. Now, the governor has threatened a veto of this. Not exactly surprised. I think it's probably a political thing more than anything else. But what do I see here? I see state government, state elected officials, state public servants standing up and saying, we need to put some effective methods, measures to make sure that the vote is accurate. The vote that is reported is the vote that actually took place. Because anything less is not a republic. Anything less is what, an oligarchy, a tyranny? Who knows? But then we have another example of, is there something being hidden? In North Carolina, the House Freedom Caucus wanted to examine the voting machines. There have been questions about the accuracy of these voting machines. Can they be tampered with? Can they give out false data? There has been evidence produced. There are videos of false tallies coming out of some of these voting machines. So the North Carolina House Freedom Caucus wants to examine the voting machines. Now, the North Carolina Board of Elections denied that request. Okay, that's interesting, but here's what really got my attention. Why did the North Carolina Board of Elections deny the House Freedom Caucus the ability to examine the voting machines? Well, see, they claimed that there was a federal authority under the Cyber and Infrastructure Security Agency to prevent them from doing that. Now, I want you to stop and think for just a second. This is a state election. The federal government does not have the authority to tell a state how to run its elections. Congress has the authority to modify regulations for the House and the Senate elections. In other words, elections for members of the U.S. House and U.S. Senate. That is all. Period. End of story. So when the federal government claims that they have the authority to tell the Board of Education that they can't allow examination of these, that is a problem. That brings up a question. What is being hidden? Now, I understand a certain bit of logic. Again, I spent 30 years in IT. I understand the IT aspects of it. Once it's examined, is it still secure? Can it still be used, or does it need to be reset, right? To me, that's the simple answer. It's like, okay, examine the machine, understand this machine is going to be completely wiped and reset back to defaults after it's examined, because we don't want to take a chance that someone at the House Freedom Caucus actually manipulates the code and introduces a virus or some malicious software in there. I understand that that can be dealt with. But what really bothers me is when a state genuflect before the federal government, and simply because a federal agency claims the authority to tell you you can do with your voting machines, you must bow down. The Supremacy Clause says that laws of the United States made pursuant to the Constitution. Where is the constitutional authority for Congress or the United States to control voting machines? The answer is weak at best. Therefore, according to the 10th Amendment, that's a power that remains with the state. So I'm kind of keeping an eye on that. I don't expect it to go anywhere, because most people have no clue what the Supremacy Clause says, what it means. Let's face it, most people don't know what the Constitution says anyway. And that's especially true for lawyers and judges. Lastly, our favorite Biden administration has issued a couple of interesting documents. One titled Federal Law Constraints on Post-Election Audits, and the other Guidance Concerning Federal Statutes Affecting Methods of Voting. This goes back to what I was just talking about. the federal government has very limited influence on state elections. And there are, all elections are state. The only election that's not a state election is when the presidential electors actually vote for president. So the federal government does not have the authority to tell a state how to handle audits. They can, Congress can pass a law that modifies the time, and they can modify the place and manner of holding elections only for senators and representatives. That's it. Article 1, Section 4. The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof, but Congress may at any time make or alter any such regulation except as to the places of choosing senators. So the time, place, and manner can be modified by Congress. What does that have to do with audits? What does that have to do with guidance affecting methods of voting? This is a guidance from the DOJ. This has nothing. This is not Congress. This is the executive branch. The Department of Justice has no legal authority to place constraints on post-election audits or on the affecting the methods of voting. Only Congress has that. That is why we must know and understand our Constitution so that we can look at this mess and say, sorry, DOJ, sorry, President Biden, you don't have the legal authority to do this. So we're just going to ignore it because, as Alexander Hamilton said, as the Supreme Court in Marbury versus Madison said, an act of a delegate authority contrary to the commission under which it is acting is void. It's empty. It's meaningless. And we need to start acting that way. We need to stop genuflecting to Washington as if they are the supreme rulers of everyone in this country. That is not true, at least unless the American people sit back and allow themselves to be turned from citizens into subjects. Sadly, many Americans have, but you don't have to. And the way you learn to be a citizen rather than a subject is a little reading, a little discussion, a little studying, and a little debate. And you can find out more both here at America Out Loud and at my other website, constitutionstudy.com. You can hear this program and all of the America Out Loud radio programs on the iHeartRadio Network or on the America Out Loud media player from a web browser. You can try out our apps on Apple, Android, and Alexa. They're available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, both for the live program and the podcast. So check them out and join me here next time for the Constitution Study.
Maybe you'll stay out of jail, love the neighbors, and have a few good friends.